once you discover Freemasonry, you can no longer consider it a secret society. No, leaders of finance, industry, politics, and religion have all knelt at the altar of Freemasonry. No, they are not a secret society, but a society with secrets. You can find all the documents, pamphlets, everything you want to learn all you want to know about Freemasonry, questions and answers frequently asked, even talk to Ernest Borgnine. They've all been members of the Lodge. Yes, in almost every nation, in every country, we find the leaders of corporations, the leaders of politics, all kneeling at the altar of Freemasonry. But we don't know why. What is the purpose of these rituals? Why do they go behind these locked doors? And what is the secret inside of the Freemasonic Lodge? Well, tonight we have a very special guest. Tonight we are going to get deep inside of the Freemasonic Lodge, one who is an insider, member of 9 esoteric orders. You don't want to miss this. Broader X will be right back on the Free Zone. Of the Druids, the cryptic Royal Archmason, Knights Templar, and Mason, along with Rosicrucian. Stan has so much knowledge that the Worshipful Master here in Kansas says that we have to speak with him, that he will blow our minds with the details and understanding of the secret war inside of Freemasonry. Welcome to the show, Frauder X.
Oh, thank you, Freeman. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's fantastic that you are wanting to come out, and come forward, and discuss some of the inner secrets and mysteries inside of Freemasonry. There is so much confusion out there as to what this brotherhood is up to that I feel we need to get right to the source to find some answers. Now, we know that George Washington and most of our presidents have been members of this secret society. We find this in the very roots of our nation and how we form our very lifestyles. So why don't you open the door to this lodge room by first just telling us what led you to Freemasonry and why did you go to the altar?
Okay, great. Well, first of all, bear with me because I'm just getting over a cold, so my voice is kind of scratchy, but I'll try to keep it clear for you. I just want to also take a moment and just say a warm greeting to all the listeners out there, especially all the faithful fans of your show and yourself from your chat lines. I've been frequenting the chat lines for the last couple of weeks, and there's a lot of great people out there that are listening, a lot of truth seekers.
The Friends of Freeman are fantastic people. Best people I've met in the world. Okay, go on. So.
They're great. They're great. I also wanted to say a greetings to all the Brother Knights and Masons who might be listening out there. May you brothers out there find your own light. And also a shout out to all the etheric warriors out there, especially in the Pacific Islands, and especially to my family. I want to thank them for affording me this time to share with you tonight. And thank you, Freeman, for inviting me into your circle.
You're very welcome.
Okay, well, I think the best place to open this story is in my adolescence. The story opens, for the sake of this discussion, in 1984. I was born in 1970. I'm 40 years old. And in 1984, when I was 14 years old, I was very well-read already, and I was already experiencing what I thought was an impossibility of reconciling what I considered my independent thinking with the reality all around me in our postmodern American society. I I was steeped in mythology and Jack London. I was reading War and Peace, and I was trying to write short stories about drug-addled, disillusioned Vietnam vets. My high school English teacher at the time recommended that I read a book called On the Road by Jack Kerouac. That book had such a huge impact on me as a young man, although I didn't really understand it, I think, until years and years later. It struck something, a chord deep inside of me. His way of viewing the deep sense of an American spirituality, or what I guess you could call some sort of mystic celebration of pop culture, was just something signature to me. And it caused me, I think, to seek answers. And I went out into the world with eyes wide open, looking for that truth that I believed was redemptive. And this led me through many experiences back and forth across the nation. I had my time with the Rainbow Families and the Road Kids and the different gatherings across the nation through the 80s and 90s. And basically, after many travels that we will go into as we go on, I ended up, at 19 years old, I met a church of believers, and I became interested in Christianity. I hadn't really been exposed to people who were practicing it in a very very committed manner, trying to live the word. And I felt a tug inside of me, a yearning for the spiritual. And so I gave myself to that system of belief and practice. But after a couple years, I became disillusioned for many reasons that we don't need to go into. Everybody's had their experiences, I think, with organized religion, so they can relate. But I inevitably found that same independent thinking that I could not reconcile with everyday status quo was interfering with my ability to, quote-unquote, submit to the will of the body or the elders or the teachings that were being implied. And as time went by, I ended up moving on. Now, in the 90s, there was a big New Age movement, and it really, I think, woke up a lot of people. It led me to goddess studies, I think especially because I was responding to sort of a reaction going from the patriarchal Christianity, taking a look at other things. I got involved in looking at Eastern philosophy, Zen Buddhism. That was also because of the being exposed to the beat writers, especially Jack Kerouac and Ginsberg. And after a while, I also started taking a look at Celtic shamanism, having that in my nationality, Irish, Scottish descent. So as time went by, all these influences affected what I would consider a paradigm shift in my inner spirituality. And I think it was right along, coinciding with our generation, you know, as a people. I think the people from our generation can really relate to that paradigm shift that seemed to occur in the 90s. I'm sure you too could probably relate to that.
Sure.
So anyways, I ended up making my way back to the East in the hopes of trying to find myself after all these experiences. And somewhere along the way, I met my wife. And when I met my wife and began to start a family, I woke up, I think, to the biological, you know, imperatives that such a thing can have, impact that it can have on a person. And I was, I think, looking for some way to reconnect to meaning. And
to become a member of 9 esoteric orders, including the Druids, the Rosicrucians, and the Masons?
Yes, because inevitably what I found as I looked at Freemasonry and other traditional lodge systems is that it did speak to the individual thinker, the individual, the person that was, even though that may sound confusing, because it's a collective, it's an organization in which people come together as a body of members. But what was clear to me when I looked at Freemasonry was that it actually was assisting the individual in total self-actualization and finding their destiny, whatever that may be. And I believe that had a big part in causing other organizations like the church to view Freemasonry and other lodge systems as a threat to mainstream systems of control or guidance, however you want to look at it.
Well, they called Freemasons lunatics, according to the guy at the New York Grand Lodge, and they had to do their rituals at night so that people, as he said, wouldn't kill them.
Well, the, you know, is that a quote from long ago, or is that something recent?
Oh, that was me showing Dan Fogler around the New York Lodge and where the UFO flew over in on 10/13.
And your guide told you that?
I think our guide was having a bit of fun with us, yes.
Well, New York has got a rich tradition of anti-Masonic movements, and that's because, obviously, September 11th, 1826 was the day that William Morgan, Captain William Morgan, was arrested and then a few days later disappeared. So
yes,
I'm not
another
surprised to quote. Excuse me?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just reflecting on that that William Morgan was another 9/11 event. But
that's
go on.
Correct, yeah. It's remarkable, isn't it? You know, the Morgan affair plays such an important role in the image of Freemasonry. And let's just take a moment and look at that. The disappearance of William Morgan effectively created a wave of anti-Masonic fervor across the United States of America.
There was even a political party, right? The anti-Masons. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. Go ahead. As a matter of fact, the first third party in America was the anti-Mason party. And it was led by a man who was a former Mason. So, yeah, that's the first official third party in America.
That's right.
Was the anti-Mason party. So that is remarkable. And there's a lot of other peripheral, lateral, remarkable things about the story of William Morgan. For example, William Morgan's widow went on to marry Joseph Smith. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Oh, the Mormons, huh?
Yes. And as you know, the legend has it that, well, first of all, we know that Joseph Smith was a Mason and that there was a huge influx of Mormons into Masonry in Nauvoo. Back in the 1800s. From what I understand, and one of the books that I've looked at that I think is really a good book to read about this, The Morgan Affair, is Henry Coyle's Freemasonry Through Six Centuries. It's a two-volume set from the 60s. He did a lot of his homework there. It's a really good read. He's very thorough. But basically, it seems that Joseph Smith, when he came into contact with Masonry, he liked what he saw. And from what I understand, Temple Mormonism is basically the ritual of the three degrees of Freemasonry converted into Mormonism. So
and we're going to talk a lot about these rituals because just to state it clearly, I have never sworn a blood oath to the Brotherhood. So I can actually out some of the secrets that Frauder X cannot. And, you know, honestly, Frauder, I'm going to push you as far as I can.
Well, you got to take the opportunities where they come, right?
Absolutely. So carry on.
So in my travels, especially in the late 90s, you know, as I think we reached a quickening in our culture and all of us began to consider the implications of the lives we were leading collectively and individually, I began to look around at this. Well, first of all, I came late into the game of the whole JFK phenomenon. I didn't even see the movie when it first came out because I was out on the road, you know, away from movie theaters and TV, you know, TV sets. So I wasn't exposed to that whole fervor. When I came back in and saw that movie by Oliver Stone, I was really surprised. I had completed the whole conspiracy theories around the assassination. I had missed that whole thing. And I became intrigued, and it became an obsession. And so I began to read everything I could find on it. And as you know, once you start down that rabbit hole, you know, one book after another, after another, after another, and the next thing you know, I'm reading, I read a book called Everything is Under Control, the Encyclopedia of Conspiracy Theories by Robert Anton Wilson. And that led me to Philip K. Dick and also David Icke. David Icke, the reading of The Biggest Secret was one of those moments in your life where I was stunned by what he was saying, and I had never heard any of that stuff. And then, of course, I went right out and got all the Zachariah Sitchin books to try to piece this stuff together, and then I went to the...
So this is all before you knelt at the altar?
Absolutely, before
okay.
I knelt at the altar.
Just
and I was in a frenzy. Yeah, I was in a feeding frenzy of just trying to find out what's behind all these mystery traditions and these esoteric orders. And as time went by, and I began to expose myself more and more to it, I began to see a pattern forming. And I understood it, I think, because I come from the unique perspective of somebody who is always kind of marched to a different beat than the rest of the pack. So I was able to see that, hey, wait a second, there's a lot of hype and a lot of misinformation going on. And maybe there's something to this that's not as clear as it seems. And maybe it's not what people think. Because so much in life, to me, I'd come across and realized that it wasn't what people thought in the beginning. Once you look at it, all of a sudden you see something else. And one of the biggest things that happened to me is that I came into contact with information regarding my own family's genealogy and found that I traced it back to the 13th century in Scotland and found that I came from a long line of people involved in fraternal orders. And that was had one of those effects on a person, I think, where it just woke me up to the realization, maybe this is why I'm drawn to this. Maybe there's something to all this.
I've wondered that a lot myself, if I could just interject, because I went to the Temple of the 33rd, the Supreme Mother Council of the World, and in the room dedicated to Albert Pike, they brought me a copy of Morals and Dogma. Now, I am a fan of this book. It's very chivalrous. It has a lot to do with knighthood, but that wasn't the point of me bringing these up. What it was as they brought me the book, they also handed me my grandfather's membership card with all of his degrees listed, what lodge he had been a member. I was blown away by this, the fact that the Masons had all of this database of all of the brothers that going back throughout time. And I found that my family goes back through time in this society as well, and I came to the conclusion that I became a conspiracy theorist because of my genetic memory, because it's ingrained in my DNA. I really think that.
I think there's something to be said for that, and you know, it's true that anyone out there, if you have any family members that have been Masons, if you just know their name and their birthday, or even just the jurisdiction where they were a Mason, which is the state or the area, you can find out. You know, every Grand Lodge system has a database on every order they were in, what rank they were, everything that there is to know is on file. And they've all become automated and computerized now. Now, you mentioned Albert Pike and Morals and Dogma. Can we talk about that for a moment?
I would love to talk about Albert Pike. If I could also add in, I just stopped by the Kansas Grand Lodge. Now, if you guys want to see some of this stuff, see some of the inner workings of the lodge, wonder what, you know, Frater X has been through as we described some of the rituals throughout this show, you can go over to freemantv.com and just click on the photography section and click on view with pick lens and you'll get a little slideshow. And as I have been inside more lodges than probably most Masons and I have pictures for you all. So if you want to follow along with the imagery, you can just do that, right-click it so you don't lose the stream and go over and check out the imagery. But I was in the Kansas Grand Lodge yesterday, and I happened to pick up Albert Pike, the man behind the monument, and started to read it, or just, you know, skimming it a bit, and already I started to like Pike again more. Now, here we're talking about a war criminal, the only war criminal to still have a statue in Washington, D.C., out in front of the square, and a time-honored Masonic scholar who has written the very rituals and explanations to the rituals in a book known as Morals and Dogma. Now, Albert Pike is a very interesting character, and many of them have connected to him to Luciferianism. So tell us what you can about Albert Pike and what you think.
Well, I think that he is worth study. He's a man of mystery. Supposedly, he was a giant man, you know, over 6 feet tall, over 300 pounds. He spoke supposedly five or six languages. He taught himself ancient Sanskrit and ancient cuneiform at, you know, 70 or 80 years old. I mean, this is a remarkable legends attached to this man. And like you said, he was a war criminal. He was literally convicted of treason for the Civil War. He was a brigadier general who commanded a Confederate battalion. And he was referred to as General Pike till the day he died, even as a war criminal, which is, I find, quite remarkable. There's a lot of little things, too. You know, the Supreme Council in South Carolina, at Charleston. This is the mother council of the world for the Scottish Rite. And it just so happens that in 1860, on the Democratic National Convention, this was held at the Supreme Council. And as you know, being a student of history, that South Carolina was the first state to secede from the Union. So I think it's remarkable that the home of the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite was at the center of the Civil War. And once again, their grand poobah, Albert Pike, it was at the helm. Now, as you could probably imagine, I am not a Scottish Rite. And one of the reasons why I assume the identity of Freighter X tonight, not only because it does, it creates a little bit of mystery, but it's also because I want to speak candidly about things that I've witnessed in Masonry, that things that have caused me during my time as a Mason at many times to consider leaving Masonry because of these things. And one of these things is the claim that Scottish Rite has as an authority on Freemasonry. Scottish Rite is in no way Freemasonry, even though everyone believes it is.
Okay, well, we're coming up close to the break. List off some of the esoteric orders that you are a member of, and then let's kind of break these apart a little bit on the other side as to what's the difference between a York Rite or a Scottish Rite or a Cryptic or a Royal Arch. how many esoteric orders are we dealing with? Does Freemasonry compound with the Skull and Bones Society? How does this all go together? If you could answer these questions, I think it'd be fantastic. Now, let's just start with what orders you're a member of.
Okay, well, like you said, there are so many orders. The key to this all is the Blue Lodge. The lodge in every town in America that you see with the square and compasses on it, that is called a Blue Lodge. That's a regular 3-degree lodge. Anyone who joins a lodge in any town in America or anywhere in the world and goes through the first 3 degrees becomes a Master Mason. At that point, you are eligible to join literally hundreds of different orders and appendant bodies, many of which you do not even know exist until you're asked to join them. Having said that, I belong to the Blue Lodge, which is the 3 degrees of Entered Apprentice, Fellowcraft, and Master Mason. I also belong to the York Rite, which recognizes the Blue Lodge as one of its bodies and 3 other bodies, the Cryptic Masons, the Royal Arch Chapter, and the Grand Commandery of Knights Templar. After that, I'm a member of the Knight Masons, which we'll go into what that is, and the AMD, which is the Allied Masonic Degrees. Those are 2 invitational bodies. The 3rd one is the Rosicrucians. These are invitational bodies in Masonry.
That's a heck of a list, and we're going to get deep into this. You're into the secret war inside Freemasonry. It's Broader X on the Free Zone. Stay tuned. Freemasonry and religion. Guide to Freemasonry. That's always a good one. Have you ever considered becoming a Freemason? Yes, I have endless pamphlets on the Knights Templar, Masonic Halls, and what it is like. And in Freemasonry, they have a saying. It says, to be one, ask one. Now, this is a very mystical statement, really, because in order to join a Freemasonic lodge, you cannot be recruited, per se. More, you have to seek the lodge of your own free will. So why don't we talk a little bit about the lodge, talk a little bit about your orders and how these separate orders work, and then let's get into what it's like to do one of these rituals.
Okay, well, let's just for a moment recap that first section by saying this. My background that led me to Freemasonry, I would say, is one in which I discovered, like many people, that I felt disillusioned and disconnected from the sources of life and goodness around me. And it was in that state of alienation that I sought answers. And I went to many different systems, and the one that seemed to fit was the traditional Western Lodge systems for me. And having said that, the bodies that I belong to, as the last one I said, was the Rosicrucians, which is another invitational body in Masonry. And then you mentioned 2 other bodies that are not in Masonry. And one of them is the Ancient Order of the Druids, and the other one is the Builders of the Aedetum, or the Boda. And both of these bodies may not be predicated on Masonic membership, but they were, in fact, founded by former Masons or people that were currently Masons at the time. So it's definitely in the same tradition and using the same tools, which is an important thing to consider when we look at all these varying bodies. You spoke of the Skull and Bones earlier. The Skull and Bones has no connection to Masonry. You don't even have to be a Mason to be a Skull and Bones. It is a fraternal order. It is a lodge system that utilizes the same tools, has the same toolkit, but it's using them in different ways. I don't know what they do because I'm not a Skull and Bones.
Right.
But, let's see. Well, anyways.
Well, we're on to... Okay, with all of that I've studied, now, there is a lot of information out here on Freemasonry. There are a lot of Freemasons out there, such as Knight and Lomas, such as Manly P. Hall, and many others, members of the Order themselves, trying to figure out what the Mason ritual really means. What is the secrets behind it? Why are they... Because most Masons will go into the lodge and they won't know much, and by the time they get out, they won't have learned much. But other Masons, such as yourself, are seeking answers and trying to, enlighten the rest of us on the ideas that are hidden and secret within the Order. So tell us, first of all, why are these things secret?
Okay, well, that's a big issue to go into, the secrecy of a lodge. Let me just say a couple things about the things that you said here. I wanted to kind of catch a few of the points you made. Like, one of the things you said was you made a comment that you're not recruited into the Blue Lodge in the first 3 degrees, which is true, but you are recruited into the other orders. That's the key.
So
you may not be recruited into...
If you had a tendency towards, say, Kabbalah or magic of some sort, then another member of another order might recognize this in you in the lodge and then ask you or tap you on the shoulder or something?
Yes, exactly. Hmm. And also, there is that specific, like if a specific order saw the aptitude of another member and wanted to recruit them for their order. But then there's also the different rites, like the Scottish Rite and the York Rite, which are rites that are literally encamped within the system of Masonry. And they seek, and the Shrine is another one, the Shriners. These organizations are not Masonry. They are, in fact, organizations that predicate on the membership of Masonry. Now, the York Rite is different because the York Rite says that it is Masonry because it has the Royal Arch degree in its system, and there's a lot of reasons why. It recognizes itself as more Masonic, say, than the other orders. But, in fact, the other orders, like the Shrine and the Scottish Rite and the hundreds and hundreds of other orders connected to Masonry, are not Masonry. They just... Membership in those orders are predicated on membership in Masonry first. And yes, they are vying for membership. I mean, as with all organizations right now in America, everyone's hurting. Everyone has low memberships, low dues. People are financially struggling. And as we all know, members, it's all about politics and money. You know, it's the demographics. It's the member money dues and who controls them and who also is the authority. It's also all about recognized authority.
Well, so I got a little bit of insider note that perhaps the Scottish Rite was coming in and sucking all the money from the rest of the lodges. Is this something that you are the reasons that why you're against the Scottish Rite?
That it's more than that, but I have personally witnessed underhanded dealings in which Scottish Rite members in lodge systems have finagled through questionable means to take control of different assets of the lodge and to take the helm of organizational administrative control of different charitable endeavors and using... See, the Scottish Rite is one of those things, like, it's all about flair. You know, it's impressing you with the 32 degrees. You know, we love large things. You know, why have 3 degrees when you can have 32 degrees? It sounds like you're so much higher up there, right? But inevitably, the Scottish Rite began as a novelty. It was simply a novelty that in the 1760s, itinerant or sojourning Masons traveling through America, these were itinerant people that were traveling around, sold patents into the Scottish Rite for cash to live on. They were basically peddling patents to anyone so a man could travel from town to town in America, go into a Mason's lodge and say, hey, you want to be a 32nd degree Prince of the Royal Secret? And it sounded like a big deal. and then they'd communicate a simple little procedure to you, and boom, give you a patent, you paid your $5, and now you're a 32nd degree, and you're impressing all your friends with the big numbers. But what is it really? It's nothing. There's nothing behind it. It's just it's an illusion. It's a smoke and mirrors. And this is something that went on for so long unchecked, because there's a curious aspects to human behavior. We will do the least, I think. In many cases, people seem to just, they'll do the least that they can get away with to get something. And if you're going to give them 32 degrees for doing absolutely nothing, they're going to take it. And, you know, meanwhile, they're in an organization that's all cloak and dagger and secret, so nobody can ask anybody questions, because you could say, oh, I'm sorry, that's secret, I can't tell you that, I'd have to initiate you in another order, and just play it off. Well, I've found that when you go further with that, there's nothing behind it. They're just using that to deflect you, so they don't have to answer your questions. So,
right.
You know, I don't know if I made a lot, I kind of jumped around a little, but now moving on to secrecy. And I know that this is a huge issue with many people. And I certainly understand the concerns of secrecy. I mean, secrecy in and of itself seems like a negative virtue, something that shouldn't be not even a virtue, just a negative aspect of everyday life. Keeping secrets doesn't seem like a good idea.
But no, I have a guide here. It says, A Partner's Guide to Understanding Freemasonry. And this is due to the fact that the men go off to the lodge, they do their little secret rituals in the dark there, and then they come home and they can't tell the wife anything about it. So secrecy can't really cause a lot of issue.
Yeah, and you know, it's something that has caused so many issues that people have, it's led people to take on innovative strides in order to get around it. Like when I came into Masonry and I asked the brothers, well, what do I tell my wife? Because she's asking me about these secrets that she wants to know, and she can't be a member because she's a woman. Well, they always say, first of all, she can join the Eastern Star or the White Shrine or whatever. But then they would literally look at me and they would say, tell her whatever she wants to know. And it was like an unofficial thing that was told to me. Tell her whatever she wants to know, because she should know. And that had a big impact on me, you know, because I found that even my mentors within Masonry felt like there was something out of order about all this. So then I knew that...
Well, we're coming up on the break here, Frotter, so when we get back, we're going to pick up on the ideas of secrecy, pros and cons, and just why all these rituals are secret, and the rituals themselves. So much coming. We got a couple hours. Stay tuned. So as I was saying, I was just at the Grand Lodge of Kansas, and of course I find it very intriguing that the Grand Lodge's seal is a couple of, cherubim or angels with cloven feet. Just one of the few things I noticed while there. But the idea of secrecy. We had been given quite a tour by, I guess, someone who's going to become the general secretary of our region in Freemasonry. Someone that Frotter X actually knows. They took us all through the lodge and allowed us to film and take pictures. Now, you can visit many lodges. They are not secret. A lot of them are National Heritage buildings that you can go take a tour, enjoy. And I plan on visiting the one in Philadelphia while I'm there giving the talk at the Free Your Mind conference. But while we were at this temple and we stepped downstairs, we found a few curious things. And we had picked up some of the ritual tools that were laying there, and one was a large mallet that seemed to be padded and, for bonking someone on the head. And when the lady with us asked about the bopper, as she called it, the mason suddenly clammed up and was not ready to disclose what this implement was for. Now, this was part of the secrecy, as the two masons we saw, eyed one another to not answer this question. But secrecy can go to another level as well, as we made it to the basement, the pump room, if you will, of the Grand Lodge there. It turns out that in the floor plans, they do not have this pump room in the diagram, and a Freemasonic conspiracy theorist that had joined the lodge decided to punch a hole through the wall there to see what secrets were inside. Secrecy. This is one heck of a topic, Frotter X. Let's see what I would like to know your reasons behind the secrecy and what you think it's good and bad for.
Okay, well, one more thing to say, you know, about the pursuit of things esoteric. You know, I think that most people, seekers, you know, truth seekers and just seekers who, like myself, I feel like it was sprung out of a deficit in spiritual reality, you know, or just feeling as if you were disconnected, you know, and needing and searching for something that would reawaken that which seemingly has been lost.
Yes.
And having said that, Freemasonry seems tailor-made for this. And it's all about inviting transformative change into consciousness. And one of the things that I learned in my travels is that the structure of consciousness is, in fact, malleable. It is reformable. And we are capable, as thinking beings, of inviting transformative change into our consciousness. And it is that which I seek, and I think many like me seek, in these esoteric systems. And having said that, secrecy plays a huge role in this. Now, of course, in the early years of lodge systems, secrecy was a matter of sheer survival, because, as we know, during the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, well, first of all, many hermetic and magical traditions fused with these proto-lodge systems, and they had been forced underground by religious persecution centuries before. And it is that same sort of religious persecution that also found its way into the halls of Freemasonry, and basically any system that has people getting together and exploring ideas outside of the blessings of the church was considered, you know, anathema or otherwise heresy. So that's a practical side to secrecy. But we can't ignore also that lodge secrecy provides, if we look through the histories, we find that it provides convenient cover for political and criminal activities. It's something that just goes hand in hand, and a criminal element would find, you know, like the P2 lodges, right, in Europe, where you had the
Italian lodges, right, spawned the mafia.
Correct. Exactly. And there's a perfect example of a criminal element using Freemasonry as its cover. Some say that the Illuminati did the same thing. There was the story of the man that was struck by lightning outside of a village in Germany, and he was found with papers handwritten supposedly by Adam Weishaupt, which broke down the basic playbook of the Illuminati to infiltrate the fraternal orders that were, you know, numerous throughout the continental Europe at the time, as a means of finding their members and hiding within the ranks of Freemasonry. So there's that. Now, the idea, I think, even for someone, say, that wasn't like me, that wasn't seeking, you know, wasn't voraciously, obsessively reading all this material and looking into all these systems for an answer, even somebody just living their everyday life, you know, the cloak and dagger apparatus of secret systems, like the use of passwords and secret signs and blood-curdling oaths of secrecy, that would make quite a powerful contrast to the unromantic tedium of everyday life, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, so even that alone, you know, could bring in people under that blanket of secrecy. Now, on the fraternal side, many lodges in the past and in the present offer financial benefits and social benefits for membership. And these are benefits that are well worth having to many people. Now, there will always have been and always will be people who want to draw upon benefits without taking the trouble to join or support the organizations that offer them. And traditional security devices formed one of several methods of weeding out such freeloaders in the past. And so systems of secrecy, modes of recognition, would qualify people on entrance that you'd have to learn through secret initiation. And you couldn't do that unless you'd gone through the process. So that's another practical side. Now, on the magical side, or the esoteric or occult side, and let's speak about that too for a moment. You know, today, as always, there is a social stigma attached to all things magical or occult. You can see it in people's faces when you mention magical or occult. Even my children, when I say things about magical, you know, they get, oh, yeah, yeah, you know, like, there's a certain knee-jerk reaction to it. When I speak about magic, it can be defined, I think, as the art of causing coincidence in accordance with intentions. And this is something that I think is part of many systems of self-actualization today. You have your the Secret, that book that came out a while ago that talked about the law of attraction. This is basically the same concept. Or the What the Bleep Do We Know? You know, there was a movie that too, that same concept. Now, put that aside for a second. Speaking about magic and occult, back in the day, even the rumor of someone being involved in any sort of magical lodge could be enough to wreck that person's career. Nowadays, people, you know, there was that incident with the most recent election cycle, the woman who supposedly was a Wicca during high school and all the fervor that that caused. You can see right there is a perfect example of how the social stigma still exists when it's convenient. So anyways, to a very real extent, the traditional secrecy that shrouds lodge rituals can be seen as a way of helping to reinforce the effect of those rituals by preserving the element of surprise. The events of a lodge initiation, you know, they hold a candidate's attention more effectively if he doesn't know what's going to happen next. And, of course, there's been many speculation as to the vibrational effects on the human consciousness of uncertainty or apprehension or disorientation and how it opens the mind up to suggestions. Now, if the intention of those that would conduct this individual are to mislead and bind them, wow, this is a great opportunity to do that. But if the intentions of those who are conducting this individual are to lead them to a self-actualizing system of transformation that is a purely voluntary endeavor, well, that brings about something different entirely. Now,
well, we're going to have to pick that up on the next hour as we get deeper into the mysteries of Freemasonry, the mysteries of magic, the esoteric orders, and as we start to really seek out what happens to a person when they perform these type of rituals. Why were you willing to kneel before the altar and give a blood-curdling oath and... much more. We've got big surprises coming for you in the second hour. No doubts about that. Lots of good news, lots of new stuff. All the best things you can possibly imagine coming here on The Free Zone. We'll be right back. There have been centuries of research going into Freemasonry. Certainly, we're never going to cover it all tonight. Tonight, we're just kind of after the feel and the flavor. What it's like to go into one of these lodges and find out from a Freemason themselves what it's like to do these rituals. Now, there's going to be some big changes coming up here on the Free Zone and in FreemanTV.com, and I am preparing to get together my book, my lectures, and a bunch of TV and movie series coming up. And in order to do this, I have to take the time, all the time necessary that it takes to do all of this stuff. And it's a lot. And so for the next 2 months, I am going to be handing the show over to none other than Frotter X. That's right. I'm unleashing you all on him. I'm going to allow Frotter X to take over the Free Zone for the next 2 months. And while I get all of this other work done, while I get all the TV shows prepared, as I get the whole new setup going and get my lectures ready and get ready for the American Heritage Tour. Now, if you all want to join me on this and you want to come along, meet up with me as I travel across the East Coast, I will be hitting St. Louis. I'll be hitting Philadelphia for the conference. That's April 9th and 10th at the Free Your Mind Conference. And that'll be very good. We'll be going to the Mason Lodge there. I will be going over to New York, back to New York, to Washington, D.C., many points beyond Atlanta, so all of you there collecting in Atlanta, please join me. And, of course, Florida, Nashville, and a few other spots along the way. That's what we have listed so far. So if you want to get in contact with me, go over to freemantv.com and find my email. It's bluefly free@gmail.com. And send me a message. Say, hey, I want to meet you, and I will find you, and you will find me, and we will travel this country, and we'll start to become a fraternity of our own. So that is the big news right now to let you know the next 2 months will be Frotter X on the Free Zone, live and unbroken, so that you can, he has a lot of information and a lot of good guests coming as well. So, Frotter, thank you so much for doing this for me.
Oh, my pleasure. I hope that I can do it justice, and I hope that I can meet all the expectations. But
I think you will.
Thank you. I wanted to also take the opportunity right now to just say that, once again, as you stated at the beginning of the show, I am not a spokesperson for Freemasonry as a whole. I can only share my personal experiences. And, you know, as you said, a grandmaster of any jurisdiction is the only spokesperson or someone he elects to speak. But what I can share is the experiences I've had. And Freemasonry, I think, as a system, is all things to all its members. Whoever, when a person comes, they're drawn for different reasons. There are those who are drawn to the boys club, to the social network, to the mercenary interests, like if they want to do better in business and they want to build a network that way, or for, you know, there's all kinds of...
I think that's why my dad joined, to be honest with you. Sorry, this is the short break. We'll be right back after the commercials.
Okay.
I really do think that that's why my father joined, but in doing so, he ended up on Killer One with Jimmy Carter and chasing flying saucers for the government. Man, these guys are everywhere. We'll be right back with Brother X. Very intelligent sport. It's amazing the shock that someone had from discussing things with a female, feeling as if they're going to be lied to when George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, FDR, Houdini, you name it, have all knelt at the Masonic altar. Most of your heroes have been Masons. So it's interesting now that we're in this time of the Illuminati, we're in this time of the New World Order, as we're starting to uncover and unveil these secrets that have been kept for so long that are now coming to light, that we already have this fear of a person and of things and of ideas that are coming from this. So I wanted to assure you on one level that I will be checking into the show. I will be phoning in on Saturday nights from wherever I'm at, you know, giving you reports from the Philadelphia Lodge or whoever I meet or whatever's going on. And you will be receiving a whole lot more videos from me and a whole new work, and you're going to love this. So I have to take this time, and it's going to be fantastic. You guys are really going to enjoy Frauder X, and he has some great guests scheduled and some great thoughts and theories to get out there. Things that, obviously, Frauder, we're never going to get to in this two-hour broadcast.
Yeah, that's true.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to just say that, well, did you have one more thing you wanted to say?
Well, I was just going to lead you back onto the topic we were on. Now, interestingly enough, when I was traveling in a giant school bus across the nation with some hippies, I picked up the book On the Road and by Jack Kerouac. I started flipping and started on the first page. And as I read, the very sign that he mentions was passing my window. And I read on thinking, no, that had to be a fluke. We were going to the very place that he was going in the book. I picked up On the Road at the moment On the Road began. And I just shut it and said, I'm living this mystical experience. So it's a true story. Let's talk about the mystical experience. We've got the idea now. You've gone into this lodge. You've been blindfolded, hoodwinked, put a noose around your neck. You've been undressed, unrobed, put into some pajamas. And now you're walked blindfolded, being dragged forth by this noose around your neck with people with swords and hammers and mallets ready to do you know not what to. What did this do to you? How was it when you made it through this ritual? What was it like to do it?
Well, first of all, I think the important thing to focus on is why a person would go through this. Why would somebody go through this? And the only logical reason I think a person could come to is to qualify to receive something more, to receive something greater. And that is the basis of all the modes of recognition of Freemasonry, is that only those who are qualified can come into this. And it is about this qualification that we speak, not about an elite idea of somebody being better than somebody else, but just an idea of someone being trained. The way you wouldn't want someone who didn't know anything about mechanics to get near your car and fix it. They're trained to fix a car. They're qualified. They have to have access to that. I mean, it's not a great analogy, but so inevitably, that is the reason why a person would come into that. What did that do to me? What does that do to people? Why do people seek to be qualified to receive something greater? You know, Masonry claims to make good men better. You know, so there are some men who come into Masonry who don't need anything. They just want to be a member. But there are other men who seek something. They seek something more than what they're receiving in their everyday experience. And there's a book out there called Inside the Magical Law, or Inside a Magical Lodge by John Michael Greer, who's also the Grand Archdruid of the Ancient Order of Druids. And he speaks a lot about the fundamentals of secrecy. He recognizes that the important... secrecy plays an important role in communicating the constructing and maintaining of how we experience the world. You know, secrecy is a part of that communication. And let me be more specific. Communication is a map of reality. It's a particular way of looking at the universe of human experience, having potent influences on the way people understand themselves in their world. For example, you know, I can make any kind of reference in the English language, and it'll trigger certain ideas in your mind. You know, we share this web of communication, and a lot of things are spoken and unspoken. Now, this is even more true of forms of communication that are deliberately designed to promote a particular way of viewing things. The modern way, here's a perfect example. In modern advertising, for instance, you know, that supports a reality map in which manufactured material objects are seen as the natural source of inner states such as happiness or love. You know, we're conditioned to think we need something to make us feel better. That's a part of the, you know, modern advertising's way of view of reality.
Thank you, Bernays.
Now, excuse me?
Oh, I just said thank you, Bernays. I bet he was amazing.
Yeah, right. Okay. Now, we live, you know, in the midst of an extraordinarily complex web of communication, and that's one that expresses and reinforces specific ways of thinking about the world. And it's one thing to accept that map of the world as a useful convenience. You know, it's quite another to accept it as, you know, to accept it unthinkingly as the only map there is out there, or worse, to mistake that map for the world itself. You know, so you get what I'm saying? The stronger, you know, so basically, the stronger and more consistent the messages of the web, the more difficult it is to step out of the map and understand that the world can be seen in a different way. Now, this effect, if you get locked into that and can't get out of it, it has a deadening effect. You know, it could even be deadly. It's a uniformity of thought that gives no innovation, and it isn't really, you know, a free state. Now, one obvious approach to dealing with this difficulty is to find ways to break out of the web of communication, even if it's temporary. Methods of doing this play a role in nearly all systems of spiritual work. Freemasonry just represents one of those systems. And if you think about it, the easiest or the simplest system that you can think of is solitude. Now, if you isolate yourself from all human communication, you remove yourself from its reality-defining effects. Of course, solitude has its drawbacks. You know, very few people are cut out for the hermit's lifestyle. I tried it myself. It didn't work out. Human beings are, you know, they're pretty social animals, and the subtle processes of verbal and nonverbal communication, they bind human societies together at levels that we share with our animal ancestors, you know, levels that are not, they're rarely open to reason or even to consciousness. It's an unconscious level. Now, so there are subtler ways to breach that web, and one of them is the way of secrecy. Now, to have a secret is to keep some item of information outside of that normal everyday web so that it does not become a part of that map of the world that's shared by the rest of society. Now, once you do that, a gap is opened in that web, and it's defined by the secret. And as long as that secret is kept, the gap remains. Now, if that secret is something painful or destructive or negative, And if that secret's imposed by force rather than freely chosen, you know, like be to be one, ask one, this kind of breach, the one that's not that way, the one that's, in, you know, imposed upon somebody in the web, it can it's ultimately destructive. It can form madness, as you see in people that experience that kind of trauma. It's like trauma-based mind control, for example, could be viewed in that way. And so if a secret, though, is freely chosen, if it's freely kept on the one hand, like a person who endeavors to join a thing to invite transformative change, so they don the blindfold, they don the cable toe, and they go into the lodge, they put themselves in the hands of strangers because they seek something greater. And they have at least, they have even the most minuscule concept of how to go about doing that. So if this secret, see, is freely chosen, and it's freely kept on the other hand, it becomes a tool for reshaping awareness, one with remarkable powers and a range of constructive uses. And it's by the simple fact of its secrecy, a secret forms a link between its keeper and the realities of the web. You know, basically, it's a bridge to a space in between the worlds, if that makes any sense. You know, used in this way, I think.
Along with all the pageantry, I guess, as well, because, you know, we have certain items that Masons wear, the necklaces, the aprons. I have my grandfather's apron here, and we've seen some more of illustrious-looking aprons. So the pageantry of dressing up for all of this as well, doesn't that have something to do with the psychological effect of the ritual?
Absolutely, because it helps to continue to reshape. It's a method of reshaping reality, you know. And regalia, again, like with tarot cards, you know, there's on a tarot card, I think you find there's much symbolism going on simultaneously. You know, there's no like linear progression of a message on a card. It's all happening at once. But each one of the symbols in there is a trigger. And I honestly believe that contained within each one of us, encrypted into our DNA, if you will, are the secrets of the universe. And that these methods, these esoteric systems, these methods of self-transformation, are nothing less but the means of unlocking those secrets.
Well, when Dan Brown published The Lost Symbol, and of course this is as Freemasonry becomes more and more public, we went from the man who would be king with Sean Connery on up to even From Hell with from Alan Moore. And then, of course, all of the Dan Brown stuff. Now, I actually saw the Dan Brown Da Vinci Code sitting at the Sydney Grand Lodge next to H.P. Blavatsky. I mean, this was insane to me. And they were selling it at the gift shop. But when you open up The Lost Symbol, it starts with the Masonic or a man heading towards the House of the Temple, and he says, the secret is how to die. Now, when I look at this puzzle and I see Manly P. Hall's book, The Egyptians and the Ancient, or Freemason, Manly P. Hall's Freemasonry and the Ancient Egyptians, I know for a fact that the ancient Egyptians put rites and rituals, put all kinds of signs and symbols and triggers for the afterlife. So how does this relate with Dan Brown's It's All in How You Die?
Wow, that's a huge loaded question and answer. You know, first of all, Masons love Dan Brown. I mean, everywhere I go, I haven't even read The Lost Symbol yet. I always like kind of hang back and don't go with the trend, you know, as far as everybody's, oh, you got to read this. So I didn't read The Da Vinci Code for a couple of years after it was published. I thought it was an entertaining read. You know, it's great. But I haven't read the Lost Symbols, but a couple people that I know have read it, and they conveyed to me their impressions.
Well, do you think that a lot of the mysteries that you're garnishing here as being a member of Knight Templar, Knight Mason, Rosicrucian Druids, and all of the rest, do you think that you are being guided to a better method of afterlife? Is there something to this in your understanding of doing the ritual?
Well, I'd like to think so. I'm hedging my bets, I guess. Well, I, you know, when you mentioned the Egyptian rites, obviously the Egyptians, the Sumerians, and the other ancient cultures, they had a rich tradition concerning the afterlife. In many ways, I think much richer than our contemporary views, especially with their specific prescriptions of, you know, I keep thinking of some cut from William S. Burroughs talking about, having the right passwords at the checkpoints before the demons devour your soul or whatever. You know, I think that there is something. Okay, let me put it to you like this. I honestly believe that there is a metaphysical reality that is going on at the same time as this reality. And I think that there is, we face a journey after death. And I think that the esoteric mystery traditions have keys to understanding this journey within them. But I do not think that Freemasonry as a system, as it currently is applied to everyday life in, you know, nowadays, I don't think that it's a complete system for accurately navigating the afterlife. I think that there may be elements within there that are woven in there, left over, or whatever. But I think there's a better chance in coming into contact with those concepts in these modern lodge traditions than in other places. But it's not the only source. That's what I tell people all the time. This is merely one source. This is merely one way for those. It's not exclusive. Like you said, to be one, ask one. You can join Freemasonry if you want. You know, they're only jealously guarding it from those who don't join. Now, you know, if you're a woman, you'd have to join co-masonry. But that there is masonry out there for women. It's called co-masonry, and it's connected to the Grand Orient of France. But inevitably, it is only exclusive in the fact that you must qualify by being a member. So it is available if a person wants it. You know, but secrecy, the thing that confounds non-members, I think, more than anything else, is the realization that all this elaborate trouble has been gone to in order to conceal seemingly innocuous things that seem like they don't matter. Why would we go to the trouble to conceal the meaning of a mallet?
Right.
What is that all about?
Yes.
Why would a person do this? And this is huge. Because it's not about the thing. It's about the act of separating things. And what you know, you must know this more than anyone from all of your analysis of corporate media and the logos. You see that even if a symbol may not have originally been intended for a thing, it can be employed and drafted to use for that thing. Look at the swastika. It's a perfect example. The swastika was a symbol of a great spiritual symbol long before the Nazis ever came near it, that had nothing to do with the things the Nazis used it for. And what it does to our, as an archetype in our consciousness today, when we see a swastika, we have a semantic reaction. We know that represents something bad. But that wasn't the case before 1933 or whatever. You know, before that time, it had a whole different meaning, evoked a different understanding through symbolism. And this is something that's happened in when we look at all the people who have this knee-jerk judgment and prejudice, contempt prior to investigation about Freemasonry and these other orders. It's because these symbols and tools have been misused. They have been applied to nefarious purpose. Now, I learned, let me tell you honestly, it's better that a candidate doesn't know what's going to happen when he goes to the rituals because of the apprehension and disorientation, and that increases the effect. But I, like the kid that used to always sneak around and find his Christmas presents and unwrap them before Christmas, I read all the rituals before I even went through the lodge. And I'm here to tell you, I got the book I read out of the Borders, which is about to go under, I guess. Duncan's Ritual. I'm sure you have a copy of it. This book has everything that I ever learned secret in any lodge, all the way up to Royal Arch. And it sold for $14 at Borders. And I am here to tell you, it has all the secrets in it. So your listeners already have access to everything that is held secret in Freemasonry. But that's not the point, because it's not the things. It is the act of secrecy, like I, you know, tried to tried to explain, but I'm kind of nervous. This is my first time on radio. So anyways, I hope that I can I hope I've driven that point home, because it really is something that your listeners, the people out there, need to think about. And this goes along, the secret war inside Freemasonry, which we really haven't spent a lot of time talking about yet. It's because it's like the war of the hearts and minds of the individual members within Freemasonry. There is a huge wave of influence stemming from the Scottish Rite, as far as I'm concerned, that would have Masons believe there are no secrets to know, there's nothing to know except how to get involved in charities, and how to learn how to navigate the hierarchical structure of a leadership. Now, charities, we mentioned the Morgan Affair earlier. I believe, well, first of all the research I've done about charities started in Freemasonry in America in the colonial times, when Masons came over from Europe, and they also were made here by other Masons. A lot of the lodges that formed around the world were spread by English troops. There were army lodges. They called them sojourner lodges. And the English are basically responsible for spreading Masonry across the world through conquest, through imperialism. Everywhere they went, they'd open a lodge. And then whoever, you know, they would find members from the populace. Well, what happened is in colonial America, these little towns would spring up, and Masons, we take oaths to see to the general relief of brother Masons. If we know of a Mason that needs help, we are to fly to his relief. That's what we're supposed to do. So it all, the only, according to the ancient landmarks of Freemasonry, it's like 25 of them, the ancient landmarks of the old laws that go all the way back to stonemasonry. According to these laws, the only person who is qualified to receive charitable support from Masonry are Master Masons. They are the only ones qualified.
We can see that's not really being shared. When we get back, we're going to find out what this war really is. We'll be right back. You're listening to Jesus.
Well, we knew it was going to be.
Yeah. I thought perhaps you could tell us a little bit of your hopes and dreams of, you know, explaining Freemasonry and what you hope to do with the Free Zone while you've got the ring.
Okay, well...
Not to put you on the spot, but...
Yeah, well, first of all, we have secured as our first guest in the month of March, Dawn and Carol Croft. I don't know how many people are familiar with him. I think some people are. He's involved with ethericcorrior.com and the gifting movement, organized gifting movement around the world. And he'll be coming on to talk about alternative healing methods and just all kinds of cool stuff. They're great people. They've had so many adventures. You can catch the adventures of Dawn and Carol Croft on the etherickwarrior.com website. They'll be our first guest at the end of March. After that, I'm trying to secure a couple of other really cool guests. One of them is John Lamb Lash. Will be hopefully at the end of April. We haven't got the specific date, but it's either the third or fourth week in April. And he's the author of a website called metahistory.org, but he also wrote a book called Not in His Image, which is, I believe, one of the most important books of modern time. And it speaks directly to basically the recapturing of the sacred feminine. The book's called Not in His Image, Gnostic Vision, Sacred Ecology, and the Future of Belief. So he's he's born and raised in America, but he lives in Brussels, where he studies in private libraries out there in Brussels. He's an amazing guy. He's been on Coast to Coast several times, too. So, and he's also been on the Truth Frequency.
I love that you are so deep into this exploration. You know, you're up on the reptilian agenda and everything else. So it's great to have someone who is well informed on these, from the insider point of view, of what it's like to be a Freemason, and therefore can, you know, quell some of the fears, start to get some of the understanding out there. Because as I understand it, there are many Freemasons out there right now that wish to make the secrets not secret.
Yeah, that's correct. There's a big movement going on in a lot of the Grand Lodge jurisdictions across the country. It's called, they call it like Vision 2012 is one of them I've seen. Vision 2020 is another one. Basically, they're going around saying that there is no more secrecy. Secrecy's out. You know, we want it to be like everyday, you know, all the information out there. And that may be something that a lot of your listeners would be very enthusiastic about. But as I've already stated, it's not, it's kind of like, it's not really saying much because all the secrets are already out there on the shelf at Borders. You know, and what it really means to me is it's a continuation of the downplaying of the metaphysical and spiritual aspects to the system of Freemasonry and what it means to the individual Mason coming in who might be seeking something more than a boys club or a means of giving away money to put on a good face. That's a big thing that we ended on the break about charity. You know, Masonry claims to give over I think it's over $2 million a day in charitable endeavors now. You know, so somewhere in the neighborhood is over $700 million a year. Well, that's all well and fine, but the fact of the matter is that I know many Masons themselves who, once again, we all took an oath to fly to the general relief of our brothers. I know Masons sitting in lodges who are not rich. People say, oh, all Masons have money. I know Masons who are dressing in rags and living, you know, barely above means. I mean, month to month struggling whether they're going to be homeless. And they go without relief while the Masons in the lodge stand up and pat each other on the back for giving away millions to the local cancer foundation, which is questionable whether they're even doing any work. I mean, is it really about prevention or research and development or just, you know, dealing with treating the symptoms? I mean, there's so much to think about there. But inevitably, it is to me a crime against Masonry that Masons themselves could suffer and struggle daily just to make ends meet while over $2 million a day goes to these charitable orders or these charitable endeavors, which, yeah, it's great. It's great to help people that are in need. But what's the motive? I believe it started with the Morgan affair. It's a motive of putting a good face on Masonry for everybody else. And so that's the main thrust in our culture today for Masonry. It's all the focus is on the charities. And that's that, you know, political agenda to, you draw a lot of men into this order who want to get involved in that. And that is not Freemasonry as I understand it and as many other people understand it.
You feel that there are other lodges, such as the Scottish Rite, that are stepping up and taking the memberhood out of the Blue Lodge and starting to place them into other esoteric orders, and in this way start to usurp the very foundations of the rituals, right?
I believe it is literally misleading people down the road. If anybody wants to think about where conspiracy theories of the Dark Empire may lay, the only place that I could think so far in my experience is in the court of organizations like the Scottish Rite. I mean, this order, the Supreme Council is a totalitarian system not unlike the papacy or the magisterium of the Catholic Church. When a person becomes a Scottish Rite Freemason, they swear unwavering allegiance and obedience to the Supreme Council, 33rd degree, in South Carolina. That's worldwide. So, you know, that's amazing to me because the other bodies that I belong to, I never have taken any kind of allegiance swearing oath like that to any one particular entity within Freemasonry. We are invited to join, we are invited to take these oaths if we choose and are told explicitly that nothing we're asked to do will ever violate our oaths to our community, to our families, to ourselves. And that doesn't sound like what happens when you become a Scottish Rite Freemason.
I see a lot of Stars of David, six-pointed stars in Hebrew inside of these Scottish Rite lodges, such as outside of the Denver Lodge, right across from the Capitol. You've got your Rosy Cross, and next to it, your Star of David. Is this a Jewish conspiracy?
Well, you spoke of the Morals and Dogma book earlier, that voluminous work of Albert Pike's. Well, many other Masonic scholars, like Arthur Waite, for example, from the Rider-Waite tarot deck, recognize Albert Pike as a plagiarist. And they say that he stole most of the pertinent ideas, probably all the things you like about Morals and Dogma, were stolen from a book called Transcendental Magic or Ritual of High Magic Ceremony High Magic, It's Ritual and Doctrines by Eliaphas Levi, also known as Alphonse Constant.
Now, he's the one that came up with that goat-headed thing. And I'll tell you, the Baphomet, it would probably do the Masons a lot of good if they didn't go around saying things like, did you ride the goat?
Yes, it would. And that stems out of directly from ignorance. I mean, invariably, the brother that utters that in the room is usually the least educated brother in the room. I mean, that's my experience with that. And that, because it happens all the time, you know, that little chuckle there, that, the reference to that, which is ridiculous. I am interested that, I don't know if you've heard of a professor named Hugh Schoenfield. He wrote a book called The Passover Plot, another one called The Pentecostal Revival, I think it was called. But anyways, he's a Scottish professor. He was the one who discovered the Atbash cipher, which was applied to the Bible and found the secret Kabbalistic messages in the Bible. And he applied the Atbash code to the word Baphomet and came up with the word Sophia, which is wisdom. So that's an interesting aside to the whole Baphomet riddle or what the heck that means. By the way, Baphomet is never, ever mentioned in any Masonic rituals. I mean, I can tell you that straight up. That's not in Masonry at all. And I wanted to also say to the listeners out there, you know, I mean, I know that it's a big shock and a great transition, and I know I'm not as smooth a speaker as you are, and I'm trying to find myself in all this.
But it takes a few years.
It's easy to, like, judge a guy who's coming on a radio show when you're sitting there in an anonymous chat line, you know what I mean? But in reality, it is difficult to keep your, you know, to overcome the nervousness and to keep your mind.
That's right.
There's so many.
I'll tell you what, we're up on the break here, Prater. We'll pick this back up. And it's true, guys. There's never been a moment I haven't felt shy here in front of the mic. And yet I keep coming out just for you. Just keep that in mind. And thank you all so much for all the support and everything. Keep chipping in, because I'm going to keep working. Don't worry about that. There's lots more Freeman coming. I want to get hard at work. That's where I'm going. So we'll pick this up on the other side. You're listening to the Free Zone. Questions that Masons could ask one another so that they could tell whether they were a brother. Most of them relating to the very inner degree and the rituals that are performed. Now, if I just look at question number 33, let's say, and it says, where did you come from? And the response, from the lofty Tower of Babel. Many people think that Freemasonry is Luciferianism, is the true force behind the New World Order, the true force behind most of the ills on our planet, and we can hardly blame anyone for thinking such when we see things as all of the heads of corporations swearing at the altar, all of our presidents swearing at the altar. There does seem to be a conspiracy here, and I'd like to know what you think about it.
Well, I tend to agree with you that there probably is a conspiracy going on at some levels in these. I mean, there's, you know, I don't know if you've heard of the Order of Palladium, but that was an order that Albert Pike was a member of. And as far as Luciferian, that order was accused of being Luciferian left and right across the board.
Let me put it this way. Do you know of any Masonic orders that perhaps practice blood ritual?
Well, I was just about to say, of all the orders that I've looked at, and I've scoured the earth, you know, trying to find everything I can. It's great with the information age for research as far as trying to find these various detached degrees and rituals. But there is, in fact, one order that I think is very remarkable and deserves more investigation than it's been given. And that's something called the Ancient Order of the Toltec, which happens to be located right near you in the city of Topeka.
No way.
Yeah. It turns out that back in the 20s, there was these two professors at Washburn University who went down into Central America, and they were Masons. And they came across some Mayan ritual somewhere, I don't know where, but they brought it back and formed this Ancient Order of the Toltec, which is called a pageant degree. And it's a co-degree, so it's both men and women involved in this. Now, according to the history of this organization, in the 20s when it first formed, there was something like 235 members. And it stayed at that level for a while. And then it spread across the country, and there was several lodges, and there was even a couple overseas. And it rose to about a couple thousand members over the course of several years. And then suddenly and mysteriously, it dropped back down to the exact same number that it was to begin with. And all the other lodges across the world closed except for the one number one lodge that's still in Topeka. And I can't find anything else about it, but I did look on phoenixmasonry.org, and there is a ritual of this ancient order of Toltec. And in the ritual, it is the only mention I've ever found of anything to do with blood or human sacrifice. It literally mentions whether or not the virgin sacrifice is pleasing to the great rain god Tlaloc. And I fell out of my chair when I read that. So that just shows you there's evidence. So there's, you know, if you find one, there's got to be 10 others that you never saw, you know. I mean, they're out there. And that is something to be concerned about. But, you know, it doesn't take away from what I tried to express tonight was that there is an element to these systems, these traditional lodge systems and Western esoteric systems in general, that are edifying. They do have a quality that deserves consideration because it taps into ancient means, ancient systems of self-transformation. And the real war in Freemasonry that I have experienced is a war of the hearts and minds of Freemasons, of convincing people that they don't need to look at that kind of stuff. They need to stay asleep just like the rest of the population and be led by those who think they know where we're going or where we should go. And you know, that's anathema, or the exact opposite of what I think a person coming into this would be looking for. I mean, is more, servitude.
Yeah, exactly. And then you end up following the script and you end up led astray instead of finding your true enlightenment, which now there again, as we start to look at that picture, and that brings all kinds of thoughts to people's head when we talk about the light of Masonry. Are you so certain that you are not a member of something dark, something satanic? What assures you that you have not signed your soul away?
Well, I mean, in the end of the day, we all have to ask ourselves that same question. You know, that we spoke about the Egyptian rite earlier, and, you know, the big thing about the afterlife for the Egyptians is that when you were brought before the, what was it, the Hall of Souls or whatever, the judgment, there's Thoth or Set or Anubis or whoever it is who weighs your heart on the scale, right? It weighs your heart. If it's as light as a feather, then you're good to go on to the Western lands. But if it's heavy weighed down with sin, then the demons devour you, you know? And we're all posed with that question at the end of the day. Where is our heart? What are our motives? I can only speak from my own intentions. And I understand the concern of the question, but I honestly believe the concern is born out of misinformation. And I believe that only those who would go into a thing with the intention of that are going to be led down that road. But there are those who are going to be misled, of course. But in the end of the day, we have to all look ourselves in the mirror and ask ourselves, where are our intentions and where are our motives? And that's all I can go with. So of that, I have to say I am certain. I am certain. And I do believe in the system of traditional law structure and esoteric mystery tradition. I also wanted to take a moment and mention a few books that I wanted to put out there, books that might bring clarity to the subject of Freemasonry to the listeners out there.
Fantastic.
Okay, one of the books is called The Founding Fathers and Secret Societies, and the subtitle is Freemasons, Illuminati, Rosicrucians, and the Decoding of the Great Seal. And that's written by Robert Hieronymus, 2006. Then there's the two books that you mentioned, Hiram's Key and The Second Messiah. Both those books, that's the kind of Freemasonry I'm talking about. Those guys, I really resonate with those guys. I really think they are onto something.
So I like them a lot.
I think they should be looked at closely. Then there's The Meaning of Masonry by a professor from Oxford, Walter Leslie Wilmshurst, 1927. This book is the best book talking about deep and spiritual masonry as opposed to superficial masonry, the masonry of just the boys club. That is I highly recommend this book to anyone who honestly wants to take a look at masonry with an open mind. Another book, a couple books, are The Lost Keys of Freemasonry and The Secret Destiny of America by Manly P. Hall. Manly P. Hall is an excellent writer. Much of what he said spoke to me as an individual seeker. But he is the guy that uttered those Luciferian terms right there in the secret tradition, and I believe he says it again in The Lost Keys of Freemasonry.
It's true, but I also know that Manly P. Hall was never officially a Freemason, never did take the rituals, and actually was given an honorary 33rd degree just because of the amount of information he had about the esoteric arts.
Yeah, and he was like a young man in his 20s when he first wrote that. He's a phenomenon. And there's a lot of weird... You probably have already heard, you probably looked into this, about the circumstances surrounding his death, and I think you already know some of that stuff. But also, but those books, The Secret Destiny of America, excellent read. It puts a lot of this, a lot of what was discussed about America and Freemasonry in perspective, in a different perspective.
Well, you know, one thing, I got to interrupt one more time. The one thing I found most intriguing about The Secret Destiny of America was Chapter 2. Akhenaten, the man who was born 2,000 years before his time.
Yes, yes.
My uncle chapter.
And that's, you're right. That, and is it chapter 2 also that speaks about Solon and Plato's Atlantis prophet or Atlantis myth? And it's just a fascinating, fascinating read. There's so much there, and it ties right into a lot of the Columbia mythos you talk about and the corporate symbolism. I mean, it's all there.
And on that note, I have just uploaded Columbia to YouTube for the first time, my anti-Illuminati spell. Check it out. Thank you, Frater X, and thank you all for tuning in. I know we didn't cover even top of it, so you're going to get much more Frater X coming up. So
stay tuned to the
Stay tuned to FreemanTV.com because I'll keep you updated as to where and what I'm doing.